the best way to become a millionaire is to start off as a billionaire and invest in film and wine, right? Like, if you do that, then you can quickly become the millionaire that you always wanted to be.
I'm Scott McGrew. Welcome to Sand Hill Road.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
So my little sister, who works in musical theater, follows me on Twitter and occasionally urges me to tweet more about musical theater. I never tweet about musical theater. I tweet about politics and venture capital. I don't even like musical theater, though I've sat through a lot of musicals because I do like my sister. So, believe it or not, Rebecca, this podcast episode includes musical theater.
Words fall through me and always fool me.
And an amazing set of songs. Yeah, it was such a wonderful project.
This week on Sand Hill Road, Amy Noyakis, partner at venture firm Anthemis, investor in fintech, and a driving force behind musicals like Once, winner of 8 Tonys.
What's the appeal of musical theater? Sell me on musical theater.
Oh, it's a tough one. For me personally, it was just wanting to get in touch with a more creative part of my mind and my being, having spent the majority of my life on Wall Street and in financial services and in kind of, you know, a capitalist pursuit. And it was just something that I think I probably started in earnest off the side of my desk because I thought it would be fun. I thought it would be something that would, you know, teach me something that I didn't already know. But what I didn't know is that I would enjoy it so much, kind of, you know, being part of the development teams around creating these creative projects generally, you know, working with filmmakers and writers. But I think it's sort of all part of a bigger journey that I've been on.
Wall Street banker becomes involved in musical theater and movies. Sounds, you know, like a plot in which the Wall Street banker is the bad person, right? You know, I can picture you got the shoulder pads in your suit and the briefcase and all of those things, and you come to Broadway and say, "I'm here. I've always wanted to be in musical theater." what gave you the idea that you'd be any good at it, and how did you convince anyone else that you belonged in the theater?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I think early on, it was not that I thought I'd be any good at it. It was just something that was interesting to me. It is interesting because it was something I didn't understand. Certainly not a community of people that I was very well aligned or connected to. And I think if I were honest, it was just more of started as a hobby, which is is this something fun that you know, I've always loved to go to musicals. I love to go to I love to see films. I love to watch television. Let's see if I can't, you know, figure this thing out. And you know, completely happenstance wise, I was introduced to a team of folks that were working on the Once project, which is what started my journey as a producer. It was never intended that I was going to go, you know, exclusively into musical theater or be a full, you know, build my own production company. It was really just supposed, you know, how I was going to get started. And I think I used, as you do, your skills that you have you know, to kind of complement the team. They were looking for someone who understood the business side of things, who understood how to capital raise, and it was skills that I had and a network that I could bring. And so I used it as kind of like a, you know, a high-end internship to some degree, learned a little bit about the business, learned about, you know, how teams are created, learned about who I wanted to work with and who I didn't want to work with, and then found my way to sort of having the confidence to start Archer Gray. And I think, you know, as I look back on it now, when I think about everything that, that I've ever been motivated to do, it's really about trying to do things differently and in many cases trying to help change happen. And I think, you know, it doesn't take a rocket science to figure out that, you know, collecting a platform now that involves a massive amount of capital and influence in private equity and venture with a platform that is building importance in influence around voice and trends is a really good way to make change happen. So I guess I look at it now as all just sort of steps on the journey to building what has become a really special, different, differentiated and important platform for change.
I want to make that link between venture capital and creativity in a moment, but I want to, a couple of more questions about the creativity side of it. You are also involved in movies. Can You Forgive Me was one of them. I just saw it the other day. I enjoyed it very much. What is that like to go into the movie theater and see a movie that you had some hand in?
Oh, well, listen, I would be fibbing if I said that it didn't feel particularly cool to be in that position. You know, as a person who's always grown up not even understanding how this stuff, you know, happened, let alone how it got made, to be in that moment when we went to market with Can You Forgive Me, which was such an incredibly special project and a project that was actually Archer Gray's first project. It was the project that my producing partner Ann Carey and I met on.
Particularly clever, don't you think?
Caustic wit.
This is quite something. He's a wonderful.
I thought so too.
Name your price.
And so it was a long, long 10-year journey of getting that project made. And so it felt all the things that it should have felt when we walked in and then to see it have such the success and the appreciation that it had was extraordinary. Everything about that project, the team we got to work with, the creative team that we worked with, the distributor, it was a real joy and a special project. I think you know, you probably wait a lifetime as a producer to have something like that come along, and I'm really thrilled that we could have been part of that journey.
I had been talking with Hooman Radfar recently about movies, which he likes very much. And he was talking about, you know, someday I think I'd like to get involved in movies. And I pointed out to him that a number of Silicon Valley people, including Elon Musk, had gotten involved in movies. Mm-hmm. What advice would you give him if he said, you know, I'd like to try my hand at this? What's the entry point and what have you learned or what advice would you give?
You know, it's interesting because I think the first advice I'd give anybody who is entering a new area of that is not sort of core to their expertise is to find the right partner and to trust that you can learn from a team of experts and that you don't have to reinvent the wheel on everything. And that they're, you know, with the right partnership, you can bring your own special sauce to the conversation and to the project without having to just reinvent the wheel, right? There's a lot of people that have been working really hard in this space for many, many decades, and there are a lot of great people out there to work with. And I think if you can subjugate your ego to a degree that it doesn't have to be yours at all times, that's probably a good way to enter it. It can be a tricky business to enter on your own. I don't recommend. I mean, look, there are lots of ways to go about it. I think particularly for those of us who have the privilege of being able to financier, you know, act as a financier on certain projects, you can use that certainly as an entry point. But I think you have to be very careful to make sure, again, that you're working with the right people and that you're doing it for the right reasons. I remember one of our early days, we were working with some investors on a project and we raised capital outside, which I don't tend to do much anymore on the financing side. And the investor came back to us after, I don't know, 6 months or so. We sent them a check because we made money off of what they invested in, which is what we said we would do. And they were really quite shocked and said, you know, I don't understand where does this money come from? And I said, I suppose that was your charitable investment in the arts, but you know, we pitched you an idea and that idea made money and that's your return on your investment. But it was a novel concept to him, which can be dangerous.
They call it the entertainment industry for a reason. It's supposed to make money.
But what do they say? Yeah. They say the best way to make money, the best way to become a millionaire is to start off as a billionaire and invest in film and wine, right? Like if you do that, then you can quickly become the millionaire that you always wanted to be. But I think that look, it depends on what level you want to come into it at, right? I mean, if it's just something you want to be a participant in, you want to, you know, learn, find somebody that you can attach your financial capital to and let them do their job, right? And that's a big part of it. I would love to say that I got lucky. I think one of the things that has always been part of my ability to do what I need to do in life is that I'm a really good judge of character generally. And when I meet people, I can tell pretty quickly about whether or not they're going to be a long-term part of my life. And I think it's made me good, probably quite good as an investor, because if you are backing most of your time, whether it's in the entertainment industry or in the venture capital world, if your goal is to find good people and to back them, then that's, you know, that's like 100% of my job, right? And I think it's a good reason why when people ask me, well, how is it that you could possibly live in both venture capital and independent filmmaking at the same time? And I don't see them as that different for me personally, right? Because my job is to give the resource, to find the people that have the good ideas and to provide them with the resource, the structure, the access, the governance, and the connectivity to allow those ideas to grow and to bloom and to blossom and at any point come in and provide the next level of support. If I have to micromanage and do all of the things to build company A, B, and C, it's not going to work. If I had to micromanage and do all the things to create project A, B, and C, it's not going to work, right? You need to have a really good sense of who the people are to back and then let them do their job. And to me, that's why the two feel so aligned. And now, by the way, I don't know that that's true of everybody who's a venture capitalist. I think there are a lot of venture capitalists out there who do things very differently than we do at Anthemis. We don't have a tendency to just, you know, throw money at a problem and then walk away and hope for the best. And I think a lot of people currently in the market are doing a lot of that. We do believe in building resiliency in organizations, in projects, and making sure that the team is surrounded with more than just capital, but intellectual and human capital, not just financial capital, to be able to actually allow things to properly grow and give them a life. And we do the same at Archer Gray. So I guess, you know, short answer to what my advice would be is you know, be honest with yourself about why you want to go into the entertainment industry, and then make sure you're working with people that you trust, respect, and genuinely like, which has been my journey so far.
There is an urge to create that some people have. I think many entrepreneurs do. It's almost by definition, they have an urge to create. But also in the arts, whether it's television or podcasting or film or musical theater, there's just, you have to create things because something in your brain says, I need to create these things and put them out there in the world.
Yeah. You know, in the game of content, which quite often today, given all of the opportunities for distribution, it can be a game. In the game of content, I think there are two types of creators. There are those who literally need to create a certain quantity of a certain number of projects that will resonate with a certain population for a certain period of time. And then there are those of us who earnestly want to focus on quality and create things that have a shelf life well beyond their kind of distribution sell-by drop date. And who really believe that as the consumption patterns of the human race change, that we want to be on the side of creating things to consume that are worthy, right? You know, we didn't build Archer Gray with an intent to be the purveyors of, you know, cats getting their bellies rubbed videos.
On TikTok.
Yeah, on TikTok, right? There's a market for that. But I think that if you're, you know, if you're a content creator that wants longevity in the industry, that wants to and can move with the trends and whims of our populace, you know, it's going to take time and a little bit of effort to stay thoughtful. But I think it's worth it. And certainly it has been for us at Archer Gray, because I think, you know, whether it's Can You Forgive Me or Lost Girls or Mr. Holmes or Diary of a Teenage Girl or a whole host of sort of some of these projects that may not be household names, but resonate. And that's a big part of what we think our purpose is here.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
You touched on it a bit, but there's this obvious question of what are the parallels between creating movies and musicals and creating companies and growing companies as a venture capitalist. What are the parallels there?
Yeah, I mean, I would say by definition, being an early stage venture capitalist and an independent producer of content require you to surround yourself with people, founders, writers, filmmakers, actors who have really good ideas and who have vision and who have the flexibility to live and work in a little bit of ambiguity, but that are willing to partner in a way that allows the kind of collection of the group to create an opportunity for the thing that they have a vision for to grow. And that is exactly the same if on the early stage venture capital side as it is in developing a project, content project, right? And so, you know, we go into something listening to pitches, letting people talk, reading their work. And if there's something there that resonates, and it resonates because we think there's a market opportunity for it, we understand it, we just like it, and we like the people, then we figure out how to surround them with the resources, again, human, financial, and intellectual, that's going to make it easy for them to bring this thing to life. And it feels very similar when I'm backing an early stage company, or it feels as similar when I'm backing an early stage company as when I'm meeting with a filmmaker or a writer for the first time talking about a project that they can imagine seeing on screen.
You've worked hard. As people of all genders do these days, being inclusive, giving people opportunity in tech and venture. One of the things you've done is created an all-woman SPAC. That is, the SPAC itself is entirely made of women. So you've got an established company that is run by women in the C-suite that at this point doesn't have anything to do, right? That's what a SPAC is. Yeah, it's an organization of women ready to take over a different company through this special acquisition. I realize that SPACs can't have specific targets, but are you targeting something that is involved with gender and equality? Or is this just, we're going to build a C-suite full of women and we're going to create a company out?
Yeah, no. So by definition, the special purpose acquisition vehicles that are all the rage these days are meant to be designed by a team of people who can raise a small amount of capital to then go out to the market to align with a potential target. And in that kind of reverse acquisition, that company then gets to be a public company. And so we've been thinking about this at Anthemis for quite some time, whether or not this was a space we wanted to dip our toe into. And we watched with great interest how the market has evolved over the last year. And I think for me, the key was when it started to really clearly become so transactional. Something that is, I think, arguably been by definition, something the SPAC industry has done, right? It's about one transaction. What is the one company I can find and do a transaction? But just because you're only looking for one target doesn't mean that the entire journey has to be transactional. And that really rubbed me the wrong way. It felt to me like there could be a smarter, better way to do this, right? Taking somebody's company public or helping combine with a mature team to bring a company to the public market is about the most important thing a founder or a management team is ever going to do on their professional journey. And so why people would reduce it to simply, a transaction with just some random person felt to me not right. And so we sort of did our own digging and went to market with an idea that isn't significantly different than some of the other ideas out there, but it's about the who and the why that is different. And our team, which is all women, and our board is all women, bring a collective amount of experience across the whole of the financial services world, which is where we're targeting our SPAC target. But what we do differently is that we are led by impact and a focus on ESG and doing good and not evil. We're focused on diversity, inclusivity, and equity in the markets. And so we will look for targets that also believe in and understand what that means. And for businesses that have a goal of helping properly transform the financial system for good and not evil, and in doing so, create more transparency and more resilience in the financial system generally. And I think the way we'll go about it, so that's the who and really the why, but the way we're going to be different is that we are going to align ourselves with companies that truly and authentically align with our values, but that will recognize an opportunity to get to know us, to get to work with us, and we'll go on a journey together. So that's our approach. It's our I think there's huge amount of opportunity in this particular area of the industry. I think beyond just the transactional nature, there's a lot of upside in the sort of SPAC business of sorts, and there's a lot of talk about that upside. And I think for a team that looks at this as a way to financially engineer some level of positive serendipity in the markets, it gives us a really good position to negotiate and a really great position to find a partner that will really appreciate what we're bringing to the table.
You say you're going to look for a company that aligns with your values, but there's a little piece of me that wishes you would buy with the SPAC, just the broiest of bro companies, right?
You know what? It's so funny because we've had many conversations about that. Look, aligning with our values does not mean you need to be all women, right? Or all people of color. But it means you have to be able to prove to us that you actually care about this stuff. And even if you're earnestly putting your hand up and saying, I care so much about this, but I can't seem to do it. I don't know how to diversify my board. I don't know how to hire inclusive. That's okay. We've got resources to be able to help you with that. But yeah, the broiest of all bro companies, I don't know know that that's going to be our particular target.
And in walk 10 women who are now in charge of the entire thing. Maybe you could make that into a movie.
Well, it's one way to fix, right? Yeah, just to sample.
Exactly. Sell me. I asked you to sell me on musical theater. Sell me on fintech. Your investments are fintech. Why is fintech exciting?
So my partner Sean and I started working together. Gosh, it must have been back to like 2007, 2008 now. And if you can remember that time in the markets. We had a very early view that what the financial services world was on the verge of was at the hands of sort of, you know, the digital world that we were living in at that moment. It was right when the iPhone was launched. Was this sort of wonderful monumental catalyst that would forever change the way we did business in financial services. But moreover, that if we got it right as an industry and as a world, we might be able to use technology to transform the entire financial system in a way that created more resiliency, more fairness, more access, and would have an net positive impact on really the entire economy. And it was a pretty lofty thesis back in 2008. Not a lot of folks wanted to hear about it, as you can imagine. I think the first day we raised capital, it was the Monday after Lehman collapsed. So we went out to try to raise capital to traditional financial services firms, and it didn't go very well. But the good news was it gave Sean and I the opportunity to decide we were going to back ourselves. And so the business that we went off to build, which eventually became Anthemist, really was built on a wing and a prayer to suggest that we had an early view that technology would have a massive impact on the way people interact and behaved and organized around money. And sort of off we went, kind of doing our thing and making early bets in places that now are becoming relevant. You know, the Betterments of the world, the Happy Monies of the world, the currency clouds and the like. And I think we shied away from the definition of fintech because we didn't believe this was going to be the technical version, you know, the technological version of financial services, but instead that technology would enable a full overhaul of financial services. And we were really early, right? We talked about it as embedded finance. I think a lot of folks now are looking at it as embedded finance, but this idea that if you understood how markets worked, how markets were regulated, how the structure worked, you could, in essence, have an impact on virtually every industry that relied on that, right? And so what company doesn't rely in some way, shape, or form on a payments infrastructure, a risk management insurance infrastructure, a finance and lending infrastructure? And so we could see the fin opportunity in any company. And this sort of, you know, massive view on kind of what became fintech and what will become fintech, which we believe is pretty much everything, it was really a phenomenon that kind of in earnest, I think, started to pick up a lot of speed like 2015. I think the pandemic and the events of 2020 and beyond really secured our entire world's appreciation for what needed to change in our financial system. And lots of things started to fall apart. Lots of things started to creak. And lots of things started to emerge. And I think that for us as early influencers in this space, and I say influence with a lot of pause because, you know, I would say from 2008 to 2015, 16, we wouldn't have been considered influencers as much. We would have been considered the sort of wackadoos that were wandering around with spreadsheets and various other pieces of data to suggest the sky was falling and no one was paying any attention to us. But now, not only are they paying attention, I think they're listening. And I think the thing that makes me so excited about the work we're doing at Anthemist is that we have a responsibility with our influence to continue to really force authentic change. Because whatever, you know, we know what happens when something becomes popular or becomes trendy, it starts to attract a lot of inauthenticity. And for us at Anthemist and our ecosystem at large, our goal is to hold people accountable for real change. And that only happens if you ask the tough questions, you force the tough answers, and you really do require a level of authenticity that I'm not sure the market's always ready for.
Give me an example of real change, something that you would like to see in the financial industry.
I mean, look, on the kind of, you know, micro level, 2020 was a massive year for venture capital. 2021 is poised to be even better. Yet, still less than 2% of the total amount of money in the VC community, despite everything we've been talking about since Me Too, despite everything we've been talking about since COVID, despite everything we've been talking about in the world, is going to women. And even a smaller percentage are going to people of color. So that to me is, it's just the saddest stat, you know, and every time I kind of quote it, you know, a lot of people are like, yeah, everybody knows this is the case, but it has to change. And I think that people are, you know, appreciating the opportunity now to lean into that and say, you know, some of the big guys saying, oh, we're going to put $10 million against people of color, or we're going to put $5 million against women. But the reality is it's billions and trillions that are moving this market, right? And so I think we need to call for the LPs and the limited partners that back all these funds. What are you truly doing at the institutional level to guarantee that your money is getting in the hands of people that will deploy it in a way that moves the needle? Right. I mean, we're for argument's sake, we are sitting on over $1 billion of assets under influence at Anthemis. And we have managed to, without any rules requiring us to do so, put that money in the hands of 40% of our portfolio are either women or people of color. That is in an industry that we whatever statistic where globally that you want to cut it. People, you know, what excuses have you heard about financials? Oh, well, there just aren't that many women there, or there just aren't that many black people in that industry, or we can't find any good people, or there's a pipeline problem. And all the excuses aside, we just put our head down and did the work. And we found 40% of our population fit the criteria, right? So I'm tired of the excuses. I'm tired of the finger pointing, and I'm tired of the inauthenticity. I think we have to hold each other accountable, put real money where our mouth is. So that's, you know, certainly one way.
One of the things you were very early at, in addition to fintech, was you're not in Silicon Valley. You're not on Sand Hill Road. The name of this podcast is Sand Hill Road, but it's meant as a metonym, right? I mean, like Hollywood or Wall Street. It's not specific, but you have prided yourself on literally not being a Sand Hill Road address.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the greatest positive trends that has come out of this ridiculously trying time the last 2 years, is that I believe the trend towards distributed workforces and the future of work are here to stay. We started Anthemis in 2008 when Sean and I were both living in London. I think on day two of figuring out what we wanted to build together, we felt the need to tell one another that he felt the need to tell me he was moving to Geneva, and I told him I was moving back to New York. And now we'd come up with this great idea of how to build a company, and knowing that our first employee was probably going to get hired in London, we thought, you know, can we do this? And we said, why not? You know, we want to invest in companies all over the world, so why do we have to be in one particular location? And so we started a trend, so to speak, back in 2008 of hiring people where we needed people and where they wanted to be. And letting them, you know, do their jobs and keeping a really core commitment to the value system and the kind of structure of how we did things at Anthemis, but letting everybody put their own stamp on things, right? And that's a big part of our commitment to diversity, right? We've always believed that diversity isn't one, it's all. And you can't have an all singing, all dancing diverse team if you require them all to live in the same place. So we quite happily encourage people to live where they wanted to, where it made them happy, where they could get their job done. And off we went. And it's never, ever stopped us from being able to deploy capital across various different parts of the important markets that we cover, which is 50% in Europe and 50% in North America. And it has never stopped us from getting a deal, which I think is really important. I mean, in fact, in some cases, there was a certain amount of respect for how much we had to work to try to get to the person before COVID, you know, to make sure they knew that we were serious about it. But since, I think the market has really opened up to the idea that you know, it doesn't take a physical space to make things happen. And that if you are authentic in your effort to keep people connected, and you align around a sense of, I think having a strong sense of values really helped us at Anthemis, because you know, you signed up for the values, and so you could trust that how you interpreted that might be different and might be unique depending on where you were and how you operated, but you didn't worry about it because you all knew you were there for the same reason. But I'm super excited about that. I think that's going to continue.
Well, that's what my next question was going to be. Do you think the advantage you have of being a diversified, geographically diversified venture firm, when traditional venture firms stick to Sand Hill Road, the address, they've discovered during COVID that they can be diversified. Will you lose that advantage, or do you think the guys in the fleece jackets will stay in Palo Alto and Menlo Park?
Yeah, it reminds me of I'm dating myself now, but it reminds me of the late '90s when we all moved to business casual on Wall Street, and you went from sort of, you know, a bunch of guys with blue suits and white shirts and blue ties to a bunch of guys with tan pants and white shirts and loafers. And it was sort of this, okay, but have we really changed anything? We've just, you know, take them out of one uncomfortable suit and put them into another uncomfortable suit. And then they're still operating as a collective. I don't worry about it. Certainly from our position at Anthemis, you know, it helps that we've been so far ahead of the market, but that's always the big innovator dilemma, right? Is like, just because you were there first doesn't matter. But I think that we always say at Anthemis that if you know, just because somebody else is now doing the same thing that you had the idea for doing, if you believed your idea was good the first time, it's even better when other people are copying it, right? And so as far as we're concerned, let everybody do it, right? It's not going to change the types of companies that they invest in. It's not going to change their requirements for how they're going to deploy capital. That's the hard stuff. But I do think it's going to allow us to put capital in more diverse hands and hopefully pull from talent pools that otherwise might have felt like they couldn't participate in this wonderful game of venture capital that we all have going here.
Amy Noyakis with Anthemis Ventures. Now, it didn't come up in this conversation because I intentionally didn't ask, but Amy used to work at Cantor Fitzgerald. She was a senior managing director in September of 2001 and lost 658 of her coworkers in the attack on the Twin Towers. She then helped that company grow back from that tragedy. Now, Amy and I do speak about that time on my TV show, Press Here. You can find that conversation at pressheretv.com. Just put Amy in the search box. Sand Hill Road is produced by Sean Myers under the leadership of Sarah Bueno and Stephanie Adruni.